From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Martin Luther King Day, we talk about the campaign King was working on in Memphis when he was assassinated. He had joined forces with 1,300 African-American sanitation workers in Memphis who were striking for the right to unionize. King saw this as a new direction in the civil rights movement, emphasizing economic equality. We'll talk with historian Michael Honey about his new book about King and the Memphis strike, Going Down Jericho Road. And our rock historian Ed Ward surveys Motown Records in what he describes as its miracle year, 1964, which was also the year King won the Nobel Peace Prize and the Civil Rights Act was passed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the things I've come to associate with Martin Luther King Day is the publication of books offering new insights into King and the civil rights movement. My guest Michael Honey has written a new book about a campaign King was working on when he was murdered. As Honey points out, although many people know that King died in Memphis, many don't know what he was doing there. He was joining forces with 1,300 black sanitation workers who were striking for the right to unionize. The strikers and their supporters turned Memphis upside down for 65 days in the winter of 1968. King saw his work in Memphis as part of a new direction in the civil rights movement, emphasizing economic equality. He said, "We know that it isn't enough to integrate lunch counters. What does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a hamburger and a cup of coffee?" Michael Honey's new book is called Going Down Jericho Road. Honey is a professor of labor studies and American history at the University of Washington, Tacoma. I spoke with him about King and the sanitation workers' strike. Why did he think the strike in Memphis was a good cause for him to take on?
Well, you know, a lot of people didn't want him to go to Memphis because he was overwhelmed with what he was trying to do in the Poor People's Campaign. He was traveling constantly, sleeping 4 hours a night, unbelievable schedule, two or three places, different places in a day he'd be speaking. So his staff wanted him not to go to Memphis because in the past he had gotten involved in local community movements in just this way, where he stopped to give a speech, next thing he knows he's in jail, next thing he knows he's leading the movement in that place, and they were trying to avoid that happening. But he said, here are 1,300 people who are working full-time jobs at part-time wages. They're living in poverty. This is the working poor. This is what the Poor People's Campaign is all about. How can I not go to Memphis? And so he did.
Had he been connected to the labor movement before this?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the really interesting things I've been finding in my research is that he makes connections to the unions as soon as the Montgomery bus boycott happened in 1955. Through E.D. Nixon, who was the local organizer of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, and then A. Philip Randolph, who was the famous national leader of that union. And from there, he makes connections to Walter Reuther and the UAW, the Packing House Workers Union, and a whole array of unions across the country. And then I've got all his speeches before unions. He spoke to unions constantly. And his main purpose was to try to cement an alliance between the labor movement and the civil rights movement.
What was the Memphis sanitation workers' strike about, and what set off the strike?
It was about really this dignity for these workers and dignity for African Americans in a city that was still tied to the old plantation ways and thought it had solved its race problems, but really hadn't, and was very much a paternalistic, top-down, good old boy system, and Mayor Henry Loeb sort of represented that, just kind of unconscious white supremacy. But in terms of the strike, what set it off was just horrible working conditions.
Yeah, why don't you describe the conditions?
Well, most of these people worked as they identified them as casual laborers, and so they had no set hours. They could come in and work for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours until the job was done. They were never sure how much they were going to be paid for that work. They didn't have pensions. They didn't have vacations. They didn't have most of the things you would think you would have with a full-time job. And they were very expendable. They could be fired on a moment's notice. People were hurt all the time. It was before mechanization, so they were carrying these heavy tubs on their heads, lifting things up, hernias, broken backs, all kinds of injuries. And on top of that, they were making poverty-level wages. 40% of those workers in the sanitation department were on welfare, even while they were working full-time jobs. So the conditions were just abominable, and really reminiscent of the plantations and the white supervisor. All the supervisors were white, and they treated the workers, all of whom were black, much like plantation owners treated slaves.
And right before the strike, weren't two sanitation workers killed on the job in part because of outmoded equipment?
Yeah, this is what really precipitated it. You know, they struck in February of 1968, February 12th, Lincoln's birthday, which is not a time to go on strike. If you're going to strike in sanitation, you do it in the summer when the garbage is going to pile up and, you know, it's going to smell and people are going to want to get it off the street. They did it in February because they were angry and they said, we weren't thinking about wages so much as thinking about justice. And what happened was two guys who were working on the trucks were crushed to death by the garbage packer. And the reason that happened was that the equipment was outmoded, and Henry Loeb, who was the mayor, refused to invest money in providing newer equipment. So they were basically up in the back of this packer trying to get out of the weather, and the packer started, and they were mashed up like garbage. Horrible. You know, one of the men almost escaped. An eyewitness said, well, he was getting out, and then the thing snagged his jacket. Back he went. And they were both ground up like garbage. And so that was one precipitating factor. And another was on a rainy day, people went to work and they stayed around for a couple hours. And then they were sent home without pay. And the white supervisors stayed there drinking coffee, were paid for a full day's work. And that's really what precipitated it, those two events.
The slogan of the Memphis sanitation worker strike was, I am a man, and am was underlined. What was the meaning the leadership wanted that slogan to have?
The I am a man slogan sort of emanated from the ranks of the workers. A lot of these workers were very religious. There were a lot of what we call jackleg preachers, people who just preached, and they might have a storefront church or no church at all, but they preached in the union meetings. And so they had a real conception of dignity and justice based on the Bible and their understanding of Christianity. And they wanted to be treated as human beings with respect. And it was an all-male workforce, so it was, I am a man. But the whole black community took up this slogan. Everybody instantly recognized what this slogan meant. That it meant we want an end to the plantation mentality and the disrespect that white people show to black people every day of their lives.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Michael Honey. His new book is called Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. What did Martin Luther King see as his role in the Memphis sanitation worker strike?
You know, I think King did in Memphis what he so famously did in so many places. You can really see why he was so important to the movement when you see what he did in Memphis. You know, there was a lot of backlash against King and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and some of the younger people in that period, because people would say, well, he'd come in, he'd make a speech, and then he'd leave. He'd get a lot of publicity, but we're still here doing the organizing. And some people resented that. But what actually transpired in Memphis was that the local movement went on for about 6 weeks, and they were really desperate to get some national media coverage, and it was almost blacked out of the media. It was a very significant battle that was going on in Memphis, and King was called in when they were really questioning whether they could survive, whether the strike would win. He came in, he brought the national media attention. Suddenly the national labor unions, AFL-CIO, George Meany, started to pay attention. Money started coming in to the strike to support it. And more than that, when King came in, he assessed the situation immediately and gave a brilliant speech on March 18th that just shook the place. There were 15,000 people there at this speech, and he called for a general strike in Memphis of all black workers, domestic workers, garbage workers, teachers, students, everybody. Walk out and shut the city down. And if you hear the recording of that, people just went nuts.
Well, you actually brought a copy of the recording with you, so I'd like you to play us an excerpt of it. Would you introduce the excerpt that you'd like to play?
Yeah, what's happening here is that King has flown in from Los Angeles via Jackson, Mississippi. He's on the Poor People's Campaign. He's in himself in serious trouble. He's exhausted. The FBI is pursuing him every step of the way. They're wiretapping him. They've got informants in his organization. The secretary treasurer of the SCLC, King's organization, is working with the FBI. He's getting very little sleep. He comes to Memphis, and instead of what he's experiencing in many places, which is a lot of backlash against him because of his anti-war stand, even in the black community, a lot of people dissing him for opposing military action in Vietnam. Instead of that, he comes to Memphis, and people are so overjoyed to see him and so happy to have him come into their movement. And he responds to that by explaining in a way that almost nobody else could do why their strike was so important and why it was so important for the middle class to support the working class and the poor in this situation.
Okay, so this is Martin Luther King recorded on March 18th, 1968.
If we are going to get equality, if we are going to get adequate wages, we are going to have to struggle for it. Now, you know what? You may have to escalate the struggle a bit. If they keep refusing and they will not recognize the union and will not agree for the check off of the collection of dues, I'll tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. And you let that day come. Not a Negro in this city will go to any job downtown. When no Negro in domestic service will go to anybody's house, anybody's kitchen.
An excerpt of Martin Luther King speaking on March 18th of 1968. And Michael Honey, so Martin Luther King calls for a general strike here, gets a really enthusiastic reaction. What was the reaction within the labor movement to the idea of a general strike in Memphis in support of the sanitation workers?
One of the interesting dynamics of this strike in Memphis is that the AFL-CIO unions, which are white-dominated, white-run for the most part, are supportive of the strike because public employees are organizing all across the country. And the union that's involved here is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. And AFSCME is the fastest-growing union in the country at this point. It's not the biggest union, but it's the fastest-growing one. And AFSCME really needs to win in Memphis, because if they lose, the drive for public employee unionization in the South will fall flat, and they're also afraid of their national campaigns. So the AFL-CIO unions are supportive of the strike because they really have to be, but white workers themselves are very ambivalent. They're kind of worried about what's happening in the black community, which is that it's unifying. People are getting very militant. Young people are getting involved. Teachers are getting involved. The ministers are involved. And they don't know where this is going. So they hold a pretty good rally on March 5th of AFL-CIO people. But other than that, they're kind of quiet.
My guest is Michael Honey, author of the new book, Going Down Jericho Road. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Michael Honey has written a book about the campaign Martin Luther King was working on in Memphis when he was assassinated, rallying support for 1,300 black sanitation workers striking for the right to unionize. When we left off, we were talking about how King had advocated a general strike in Memphis. So after Martin Luther King calls for this general strike, then you have to figure out, you know, the leadership had to figure out, well, what shape would the general strike take, and how do you keep it nonviolent? What shape did they want the general strike to take?
Well, unfortunately, there was no follow-up to this. Taylor Rogers, who was very active in the strike and later became the president of AFSCME Local 1733, said, well, you know, we never really followed that up. It was a great idea, and they were ready to do it on a kind of spontaneous basis, and King was then scheduled to come back in a few days and lead a mass march. And undoubtedly, if he had come back to do that, the students would have walked out of the schools. A lot of people would have refused to go to work. It would have been something like a general strike of black workers. But instead, what happened was they had this incredible snowfall that just froze the Mid-South. It was a freak snowfall. And so King couldn't come back. And then they had to reschedule it, and he came back quite a bit later, and things had changed, and some of the energy had dissipated. And then a lot of divisions started to sort of emerge within the movement.
Well, although the general strike never happened, there was a big demonstration that did happen on behalf of the sanitation workers. Tell us about that demonstration and how it ended up in a confrontation with the police.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that King came in from New York City, where he was working on the Poor People's Campaign, and he came in very late. The march was supposed to start at 10 o'clock, and King was nowhere to be seen, and they didn't want to start without him. This is March 28th. It's, you know, by that time, it's pretty hot in Memphis, and people were waiting around for him for an hour and a half or so. Meanwhile, students were walking out of the schools, and there was an incident at Hamilton High School where the police came in and attacked the students, beat some people up. One young woman was badly hurt, and the rumor spread that she had been killed. So all these students started coming downtown to gather for the march, and they were extremely agitated and angry. And at the same time, a lot of the street people around Beale Street, which is, you know, that famous street in Memphis of the blues and everything else, people who were pickpockets, petty thieves, not movement people at all, began to intersperse themselves into the march. And so when King finally did arrive, the march itself was sort of out of control. The marshals couldn't keep people together the way they wanted them to be. And when the march finally did start, somebody started breaking windows. And suddenly they were in a situation where King's leading a march, and behind him, windows are being broken, and it looks like a riot is about to happen.
That was a big fear that a lot of the organizers of the demonstration had, that somehow, like, younger people or other people latching onto the demonstration would become violent, and it would change the tone completely of the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, this was the thing everybody was afraid about, having to do with the Poor People's Campaign itself. King was talking about taking masses of people to Washington, D.C., and as you remember, you know, we had the long, hot summers back then. Every summer, huge riots would take place in the inner cities, usually set off by a confrontation with the police. And that's exactly what people were afraid would happen in Washington, D.C. when these people camped in around the Congress demanding an end to poverty. So what happened in Memphis was that King was suddenly put in that very situation that everybody was dreading. And King, at the front of the march, was suddenly confronted with a whole mass of police with their gas masks, their clubs, which were 4 feet long, their weapons drawn, and he was right in their line of sight. And James Lawson, the ministerial leader, took King out of the march because he didn't want King to be in the position of leading a riot, one, and two, he didn't want King himself to get killed or badly hurt by the police. So when they pulled King out, then the police attacked. And it wasn't so much a riot of the people as it was a riot of the police. And when the police attacked, then it just spread and it became a riot of everybody.
With looting and...
Yes. A lot of windows were broken on Beale Street and various areas around there. But, you know, actually, as riots go, it wasn't much. There was not that much damage. It wasn't an attack against people at all. It was an attack against property. People were stealing liquor out of stores. But, you know, how big of a crime is that? What was really bad about it was that the police just laid siege to the black community for the next 3 days, and they brought in the National Guard, and suddenly Memphis became a police state. And this was the kind of thing everybody was hoping to avoid, seeing a repeat of Detroit of 1967, for instance.
Michael Honey's new book about Martin Luther King in Memphis is called Going Down Jericho Road. Honey is a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Martin Luther King's final speech, delivered the day before he died in support of the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. And rock historian Ed Ward surveys what he calls Motown's miracle year, 1964. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Martin Luther King Day, we're talking about the campaign King was working on in Memphis when he was assassinated there in 1968. He was organizing in support of 1,300 African-American sanitation workers who were striking for the right to unionize. My guest Michael Honey is a labor historian who has written a new book about King and the Memphis strike called Going Down Jericho Road. When we left off, Honey was describing a demonstration on March 28, 1968, that ended in a confrontation with police. Let's hear an excerpt of a speech that Martin Luther King gave on April 3rd of 1968, and this was the day before he was killed. How long is the speech after the confrontation that we were just talking about?
The confrontation happens on March 28th. And then the National Guard is brought in, and there's martial law for about 4 or 5 days. They have a meeting in Atlanta to try to decide what to do about Memphis. And there's a lot of division within the ranks of King's own organization. They're angry that he went to Memphis, said, you never should have gone there. We didn't want you to do this in the first place. King walks out of the meeting, goes away for several hours. Finally, the staff realizes that they have to unify behind him, and he says, I think we have to go back to Memphis or else I'm done as a leader. And so they finally agree to that, and they all come back on April 2nd. And then King comes in on April 3rd, and he's served with an injunction, a federal injunction, saying he cannot march. And in the past, King has always tried to not go against federal courts because the federal courts have been often on the side of the movement. So on April 3rd, he's giving this speech in the context of he's saying, I'm going to defy the federal injunction. We're going to march come hell or high water, and it's going to be a nonviolent march. So he's putting everything on the line.
And this speech is most famous for the end of the speech in which he talks about how he's been to the mountaintop. But the part we're going to hear is specifically about the Memphis sanitation strike and the importance of supporting these striking sanitation workers. So here's Martin Luther King.
The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now, we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the articles. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering, sometimes going hungry, going through dark and dreary nights, wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. And we've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. For when people get caught up with that which is right, and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping point short of victory.
That's Martin Luther King in Memphis on the day before he was killed. And my guest, Michael Honey, is the author of the new book, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. Later in that speech, King proposes a boycott of several companies who he says haven't been fair in their hiring policies. And he says, because up to now only the sanitation workers have been feeling the pain, we must redistribute the pain. And he wants to pressure these companies to support the sanitation workers and to tell Mayor Loeb to support them. Did the boycott ever happen?
Oh, yes. The boycott was actually underway. James Lawson and the other people in the movement in Memphis were very familiar with these techniques, which had been developed in Birmingham in 1963. Even in Nashville and the sit-ins in 1960, all along the civil rights movement had adopted many of the campaign tactics that the labor movement had used. Sit-downs, sit-ins, boycotts, economic coercion, strikes, arrests. So when he's in Memphis on April 3rd, He's drawing on a rich tradition that the movement in Memphis is also drawing on, and they're very effectively boycotting the downtown. The business people in Memphis are really hurting at this point in the strike, and they're boycotting both of the city newspapers. There's a real campaign to go against the media, which has completely misreported, I guess you'd say, the strike and a one-sided view of what's going on, to the point where the media didn't even make it clear to the public that these workers, by law, did have a right to unionize. They made it appear that all the laws said that you couldn't even do this, which was what the mayor said. So when King is making these calls, he's really just reinforcing what everybody is already doing.
The day after the speech that we've been talking about, Martin Luther King is assassinated. Did you learn anything that you didn't already know about his assassination when you were doing research for your book?
I learned some nuances. There are FBI files on King that fill up almost a whole room at the FBI research room in Washington, D.C. I didn't go through all those files because a number of scholars have gone through them in great depth, and David Garrow wrote a book about the FBI and Martin Luther King where he showed how the FBI was trying to destroy King by every means imaginable. One of the things that they did was J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, instructed his agents not to pass on information to King when there was a threat against his life. So they knew there were threats on King when he was coming into Memphis, but they're not passing them on to King. So in addition to that, I found that there were about 40 police cars in that area of Memphis circling around. The police were everywhere. Once King was shot, the police came out of the woodwork. Jesse Jackson was there, and the New York Times interviewed him and said, what happened? He said, well, there was a shot, and all these police came charging to us, but clearly the shot came from somewhere else. We could hear the rifle shot over in the distance, but none of them were going toward where the shot was heard. They were going toward the balcony. So a lot of people were drawing this conclusion that the police already knew what the target was. Now, beyond that, we know that there was a reward out on King's life, and that James Earl Ray somehow escaped, despite the fact that there were police everywhere, and was on his way to Rhodesia from England, I believe it was, when he was arrested. Now, a lot of people in the black community at the time did not believe the idea that it was just one person that came in and did it. I don't know what the answer to that is, but certainly King was not getting the protection that he should have gotten under the circumstances that existed at that time.
My guest is Michael Honey, author of the new book Going Down Jericho Road. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Honey. His new book, Going Down Jericho Road, is about the campaign Martin Luther King was working on when he was killed in Memphis, supporting African-American sanitation workers who were striking for the right to unionize. You write that even in death, Martin Luther King was a polarizing figure in Memphis. How so?
Well, you know, you would think that after a traumatic event like this, that the society would come together and reevaluate. Instead, what you found was a hardening of positions in the white community. A lot of people arming themselves. I have a lot of anecdotes that I found, people making jokes about King's death, middle class people, housewives, businessmen, teachers, you name it. And talking about, if any of those black people come into our neighborhood, we're going to shoot them. And after that, the Memphis police really hardening its position against the black community, a kind of a reign of brutality, sort of striking back at blacks and particularly young black males for having had a movement and trying to sort of discourage them from ever doing it again.
What was the outcome of the sanitation workers' strike?
Eventually they won, but it was not, again, as you might expect, that the mayor and everybody would say, okay, now we have to settle this. You know, this, things have gone too far. No, Mayor Loeb never agreed to a union. President Johnson was the one who intervened. He sent a labor expert into Memphis to settle it. He spent weeks going back and forth between Loeb and the union. Finally, it was the city council that signed an agreement that said that the union, that the workers would have a union, that they would have a signed agreement, not a contract, which is what they wanted, but an agreement, and that union dues would be checked off from their paychecks so that they would have a regular source of income. Those were the main things they were trying to get, and they finally got them.
You write a little bit in your new book about your own participation in the civil rights movement, and you write that, like many other new leftists, by 1968, you thought Martin Luther King wasn't radical enough. Why did you think that, and how did you change your mind?
Yeah, isn't that funny? When I look back at that, I think it's quite funny. You know, during the Black Power period, Stokely Carmichael, a lot of other people, H.R.A.P. Brown, the Black Panther Party, I had a lot of respect for all these people, were saying that nonviolence itself is sort of outmoded. Of course, Malcolm X had been saying that. There was the Vietnam War, which really, we were desperate about the Vietnam War. A lot of people, how do we stop this daily carnage that's going on day after day? Nobody seems to be willing to stop it in the government. And here comes King, you know, he's still offering the same thing. Nonviolence, turn the other cheek, integration, these things will solve our problems. And at the time, a lot of people thought, well, that time has passed, you know. But in hindsight, looking back many years later, King was the one who was talking about building coalitions. King was the one that was talking about poverty and world poverty and building a massive coalition to end that and reverse the priorities from war to spending on human needs. King still had his eye on the prize in terms of building a movement that could really change America. And I think a lot of the rest of us sort of lost that for a while, and partly because of the bitterness of the period. But King somehow surmounted all of that. He had every right to be the bitterest person of all, but he was not.
Is there a story you'd like to tell us about one of the workers who participated in the sanitation worker strike and whose life was changed by it?
Yeah, there was a man named Ed Gillis who was 72 years old at the time of the strike in 1968. And his white supervisors still called him boy, even though he was 72. And his story goes back to almost the Civil War, when he was born in the aftermath of the Civil War. And you can see through his life how he was treated by whites as a servant, doing the worst jobs, the most painful work on the railroads. He severed his main artery at one time working on the railroads. And here he is at 72 years of age, shoveling asphalt in the streets of Memphis. And he was among the group that started the strike because of this rainy day policy when they were sent home and the whites collected pay for the day. And, you know, he was somebody who had been accepting the white system for years and years because he had no choice. But he had his limits. And when he had a chance to fight back, he took it. And that was the story of all of these workers. When they had an opportunity to change things, they did. People thought that they were folks who just went along and poor people who bowed their heads and so forth. But that's where the I am a man comes in. They had their limits, and then they took their lives in their own hands.
Michael Honey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Honey is a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma. The title of his new book, Going Down Jericho Road, is a reference to Martin Luther King's final speech, in which King referred to the New Testament Good Samaritan story. In the story, Jesus talks about a man who was accosted by thieves on Jericho Road, a dangerous road for travelers. A Levite and a priest passing by on the other side didn't stop to help the man. The person who did was a Samaritan, a traveler from an ethnic group that was looked down on. Here's Martin Luther King in Memphis on the day before he was killed.
You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
An excerpt of Martin Luther King's final speech. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on a musical development the same year that King won the Nobel Peace Prize. This is Fresh Air. ''64 was the year that Martin Luther King won the Nobel Peace Prize and the Civil Rights Act was passed. Our rock historian Ed Ward looks at what happened that same year at Motown Records. It was the label's fifth year and the year it showed that it was, as its slogan would soon brag, the sound of young America today.
1964, and we gon' dance some more. You gotta keep up with the times if you wanna be mine. So if you can do it, let me know.
''64 was Motown's miracle year. Not for the Miracles, who didn't really have a hit, but for the Four Tops, who had Baby, I Need Your Loving, Marvin Gaye, who had Baby, Don't You Do It, and You're a Wonderful One, Brenda Holloway with Every Little Bit Hurts, Martha and the Vandellas, who had Dancing in the Streets, the Marvelettes with Too Many Fish in the Sea, the Temptations with Girl, Why You Wanna Make Me Blue, The Girl's All Right With Me, The Way You Do the Things You Do, and My Girl, Mary Wells with My Guy, and especially the Supremes, who finally broke through with Baby Love and Where Did Our Love Go? Not bad. But those classics only tell part of the story. Berry Gordy's company was now comprised of six labels, Motown, Gordy, VIP, Soul, Tamla, and a country label, Mel O.D. The latter sounds like a bad idea, and in fact it was, although it had Dorsey Burnett, the pioneering rockabilly singer, who might have had some success, except for the fact that his brother Johnny drowned that summer, plunging Dorsey into a serious depression. Soul was the new label, dedicated to grittier stuff than Motown released, and its very first record was a classic, although not in its original form.
Devil with the blue, that, blue, that, blue, that, devil. long now.
Shorty Long's song would make him a lot of money, but not until his fellow Detroiter Mitch Ryder revived it with his band the Detroit Wheels a couple of years later. Long, like the other early acts on Soul, came to the Motown family thanks to Harvey Fuqua and Gwen Gordy, Barry's sister, who sold their Tri-Fi label to Motown in 1964. Two other acts came with him, both of whom would be important to the Motown story later on. Saxophonist Audrey DeWalt, known professionally as Junior Walker, would also take a while to find his groove at Motown, although these first notes on Monkey Jump here are unmistakably him. The third act went straight to Motown for polishing, although again, it would take them a couple of years to find their groove.
You don't always say the words I wanna hear, but to me, you're really saying something.
The Spinners wound up working odd jobs around Motown and doing an act called the Brown Beatles, in which they played Beatles songs just to make ends meet. 1964 was also the year that Motown lost one of its major stars, Mary Wells, to another label, which was problematic not only for Motown itself, but for Marvin Gaye, who'd had a series of successful duets with her. Motown wanted to keep that magic going, so they hooked him up with a newly signed former Iquette from their VIP label, Oma Heard.
Here comes that guy with this dream of girls. It makes him happy just to take him for a whirl. Still I love him and I want him so, but for now, Mr. Lonely Heart, I can't let him know.
No, Mr. Lonely Heart, I can't let him know.
Something didn't work out. The sessions were never released, and Oma Heard's one single barely snuck out. Marvin hooked up with Kim Weston instead. For my money, the talent deserving greater recognition from Motown in 1964 was the Velvets, four young women who recorded a number of wonderful songs. Why the label decided to release this in the period between Christmas and New Year's is anybody's guess, but it sank as predictably as you'd expect. At the end of 1964, Motown had a lot to be proud of, including dozens of flops which would have been hits at any other time. They'd put the company on the map, toured their artists overseas, and, not incidentally, they'd stood up to the year's other major musical phenomenon, the British Invasion, and fought it to a truce. They'd happened upon the brilliant ideas which became the formula which would make them all rich, but because it was a formula, Motown would never be this much fun again.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He played selections from the Complete Motown Singles, Volume 4, on Motown Select. It features recordings from 1964. We'll close with a 1972 Motown classic by Marvin Gaye. I'm Terry Gross.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, committed to creating opportunities for people to live freer, better, and more prosperous lives. Online at fordfound.org. From the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Burma is the poster child for nightmarish 21st century ills, according to Thant Mint Yu. He's a former UN official whose family is from Burma. His grandfather, Yu Thant, served as Secretary General of the UN. Thant Mint Yu has written a new book about Burma that's part history, part memoir. He'll talk with us about it on the next Fresh Air. Join us.